Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas, and Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology, and she's the director of the Breast Center at Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Anish Chagpar is joined by Dr. Ranjit Bindra for a conversation about the research and treatment of brain tumors. Dr. Bindra is assistant professor of therapeutic radiology and of pathology and assistant professor of therapeutic radiology at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Dr. Chagpar.
Why don't you just start off, Ranjit, telling us a little bit more about what you do what therapeutic radiology is all about.
Great. Well, I am an assistant professor here at Yale, as you mentioned. I split my time between the lab and the clinic. In the clinic, I treat adult and pediatric brain tumors, primary high-grade tumors, often referred to as glioblastomas. In the laboratory, I do similar work, trying to translate some of that, some of the work that I do in the clinic into a research setting. And my lab is composed of about 8 people. I have some students, graduate students, medical students, undergrads, and a postdoc and a lab manager. And our main focus is developing novel drugs to combine with radiation therapy specifically for these brain tumors.
So let's start by setting the stage kind of clinically to talk about brain tumors. So you said that you treat primarily brain tumors, especially glioblastoma. So can you kind of put that in context for us? How common are these? How does somebody know if they're sitting listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers and wondering about their headache, wondering, do I have glioblastoma? Tell us a little bit more about brain tumors.
Certainly. So, the good news is brain tumors are relatively rare. The malignant brain tumors that we deal with clinically here at Yale, these glioblastomas afflict only in people in the range of 10 to 12,000 per year in the United States. Typically, when you have a headache at home, I know that feeling of, oh, maybe this is a brain tumor. Luckily, it's more likely to be just a headache. Certainly should seek medical attention if it persists for longer. But in terms of brain tumors, this type of brain tumor, they're a very unique entity because they're highly resistant to therapy. So you can cut these tumors out in the operating room, and you can give lots of radiation therapy, and we'll talk about what that means in a moment, combine it with chemotherapy, and unfortunately, these brain tumors tend to recur locally. And that's the clinical enigma that has driven a lot of scientists and clinicians like myself to try to find better therapies for these tumors.
So what causes them, and how do you know that? How are they diagnosed?
Yeah. So interestingly, with many years of research, we're still just beginning to understand what is a brain tumor, what is a malignant brain tumor, and what are the genetic events that cause these tumors. We still are far away from understanding, the exact sequence of events for these types of brain tumors. In terms of symptoms, as I mentioned earlier, it's more than just a headache. It's a patient that would, for example, I can tell you about a patient that I treated several months ago. A patient was, working in his garden one day and all of a sudden had a seizure and was unconscious for quite some time. And his wife found him there in the garden. And lo and behold, they took him to the emergency room and they did a CAT scan of the brain. And unfortunately, this patient happened to have a malignant brain tumor. And that was just the beginning of the journey for that patient. So typically, there's much more of a dramatic sentinel event that occurs for patients with brain tumors. And often seizures are the most common presenting features.
So was there anything that caused this? I mean, he was out in his garden like many of us would be, and this just all of a sudden happened. I mean, is this something that's genetic? Is there a family history? Did he eat something that was not the right thing to eat, or did was he a smoker and you're not supposed to smoke? Like, I mean, are there any things that make brain tumors happen?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And it's funny because those are the exact questions that we're confronted with in the clinic when we talk to family members and patients when they're first diagnosed. One question is, did I eat something? Is it something that I did that caused this tumor? Unfortunately, for many of these patients, much like winning the lottery, it's just a sequence of events that was unfortunate timing for that patient. And something I tell my students in the lab, we always forget this, but the human genome and inside of each cell, it's composed of over 3 billion bases. And every day, many of our cells actually have to make a perfect copy of those 3 billion bases. And often they do this in hours. And as you can imagine, every now and then, there's a mistake that's made in the genome. And what we believe with brain tumors are that there's a certain number of these mistakes that occur over time. And within years, those mistakes accumulate into a malignant tumor. And it's often just a single cell that acquires those mutations. So really the short answer is that it's really often a case of bad luck and just a combination of spontaneous mutations that cause these tumors.
So one of his cells made a mistake and he ended up with a seizure and a brain tumor.
Exactly. Unfortunately, that would be the short answer to that question.
Okay, then. So I guess that then brings us to, how is it that genes replicate? How is it that they maintain that integrity? How do we make sure that they, spell check so that they don't make mistakes and so that people don't end up with brain tumors?
And that's an excellent question, and that's actually a large focus of my lab and many others in this field. I think it's fascinating to step back and think about first the scale of things and of Mother Nature, so to speak. So a single cell is about 1,000 times smaller than the head of a pin, and within that cell is a very small structure called a nucleus. In that nucleus are 3 billion bases, all in spread amongst a small number of chromosomes, and we get half of our chromosomes from mom and half of our chromosomes from dad. And our cells have devised ingenious mechanisms, literally to scan across the entire genome looking for errors. They can detect a single base pair that's mismatched. So if you have a string, there's four bases, A, T, G, and C, and that code comprises life. And you can often have a string of T's in certain areas of the genome, and just as if you were to be typing at a typewriter, you could see that string of T's and maybe put an extra one in. And actually, that happens commonly in cells. And a single mismatch can have devastating consequences. If there's a gene that is in that area, that gene becomes what we call frame-shifted. And everything gets out of whack for that gene, and it becomes non-functional. So the cells devised numerous mechanisms within seconds to recognize that damage, that mismatch. And it can actually look at one strand that was freshly made over the older strand based on a series of marks that are placed in the surrounding genome there, and it can actually use that to repair that damage.
So your body has figured out ways of spell checking, of figuring out where these mistakes are and fixing them. But that can't be fail-safe, because otherwise nobody would ever have mistakes made.
Yeah.
And this patient wouldn't have had his seizure in the garden.
Yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing about our cells is there are backup systems upon backup systems and backup systems. But one of the – I was actually just in New York City this weekend at a concert, and we were in Times Square. And I was remarking to my wife how incredibly busy and crazy that area of New York is. And actually, it's a good analogy for the cell, because actually when you look down inside a cell in a nucleus, there's these mitochondria, the engines of the cell. They're generating massive amounts of energy and heat and all sorts of products that are essentially attacking the DNA. They're enzymes that are constantly stitching together millions of proteins every day. And often those enzymes can mistake DNA for their target, and they can actually damage the DNA. Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing is the DNA itself actually gets tangled up a lot like headphone cables when you have your iPhone. The DNA actually gets tangled up, and the cell needs to constantly find a way to untangle those. And actually it does that by making breaks in the DNA and then untangling those pieces. Now, you can imagine already there, if you have 3 billion bases that are constantly being attacked and tangled, that it would only take just one mistake for the cell for that day to create a mistake that cannot be erased from the genome in that cell. So I think you're correct. It's the fail-safe mechanisms are essential, but they're like anything else, they're not perfect.
And so in your lab, you're trying to figure out what?
So we're trying to figure out when a piece of DNA is broken, exactly how it gets stitched back together. So it's remarkable. As many of you know, we have two strands of DNA. So it's DNA is double-stranded. And one of the hardest pieces of damage to repair for a cell is a double-strand break. If you have a single-strand break, it turns out that the cell can look at the other piece of DNA, say, well, this is the correct sequence, and I'll just use that as a copy. With a double-strand break, when the sort of DNA repair policemen arrive at that scene, they actually look at that area, and they don't know what's missing from in between. So they look at that double-strand break, and it actually takes quite a lot of thought for the cell to decide if it wants to simply just glue those two pieces together, because what if 1,000 bases were missing, and what if that was a tumor suppressor gene? So our lab tries to understand exactly what the processes are involved in recognizing that strand break, and then how it chooses to repair that lesion. There's actually multiple ways to do that.
And so how does that then help us in terms of really pushing the field forward when we think about that patient who was in the garden who had the seizure, who ended up in your clinic with a glioblastoma?
Yeah, and I think your question there highlights one point first, which is the value of translational medicine, because there is a link from that double strand break to that patient in the garden, and the link is when we see that patient, we treat them with radiation therapy, and later in the session, if we have time, we'll talk more about that treatment. But we give them very, very high doses of focal radiation directly at that tumor, where thousands and thousands of tumor cells are sitting. And what that radiation does is it actually induces double-strand breaks in those tumor cells to prevent them from growing and eventually die. Remarkably, these brain tumor cells are really, really good at bringing those strands back together and repairing that damage. And for reasons that we still don't understand, they're able to recognize that damage faster, and they're able to repair it faster. And as a result, within months, these tumors come back. And that's why, to date, we've had very, very great difficulty trying to cure tumors like glioblastoma.
So you know what's interesting to me is that it's the mechanism that causes these tumors to occur, the mistake in the genes that causes the patient to get the glioblastoma in the first place. But then once they have the tumor, you use the same type of idea, right?
Yeah.
To break the DNA to kill it. But it seems like the tumor cells have kind of got us beat because they know how to fix it more than we do.
Exactly. And that's one of the focus points of our lab, because, our approach is, to the tumor cells as well, you might have a workaround, but, historically we've been able to come up with a better workaround. And so what we actually do is we use high throughput drug screening to try to find compounds and novel drugs that when we hit those tumor cells with radiation, we can treat them with a drug that prevents those tumor cells from actually repairing those breaks.
So we're going to talk more about how all of these drugs and radiation work together to fix DNA when we come back after this medical minute. So please stay tuned to learn more information about therapeutic radiology and more about how these double-strand breaks and DNA repair has a lot to do with glioblastoma with our guest, Dr. Ranjit Bindra.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year. But there is new hope. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. Women should schedule a baseline mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, to make innovative new treatments available to patients. A potential breakthrough in treating chemotherapy-resistant breast cancer is now being studied at Yale, combining BSI-101, a PARP inhibitor, with the chemotherapy drug irinotecan. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anise Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my guest, Dr. Ranjit Bindra. We are talking about therapeutic radiology or radiation oncology, and specifically radiation oncology for brain tumors. And right before the break, Ranjit, you were telling me about high-throughput drug screens that you do that are really helping to figure out how cancers can work in terms of double-strand breaks and so on. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So high-throughput drug screening is an enormously powerful way to discover new cancer therapies and therapies for other diseases. My lab generally uses high-throughput drug screening to find novel anti-cancer drugs, and we try to target the specific mutations associated with brain tumors. High-throughput screening itself is generally comprised of large drug libraries, hundreds of thousands of unique molecules. And we try to sift through those molecules to try to find a compound that will specifically affect our cancer cells in the way that we want them to. So for instance, if you wanted to look at a way to selectively kill a glioblastoma tumor cell with a specific mutation, you could screen 200,000 compounds and try to find a drug that specifically just kills those cells and has no effect on normal cells.
So is this kind of like what people talk about when they talk about personalized medicine?
It is to in many different ways. So in personalized medicine, and really the end point of personalized medicine is the recognition that every tumor or every disease has a specific set of mutations that may be unique from another individual's tumor. And that's an important feature because, you know, even back when I was a med student in early 2000s, we would look under the microscope at a brain tumor, for instance, and we just called it a glioblastoma. And there was a four or five features, the size of the nucleus, the amount of cell death, and that would label it as a glioblastoma under the microscope. We now understand that there are multiple different molecular subtypes with all unique different gene expression patterns, such that in the era of personalized medicine, our therapies will have to be more targeted specifically to the gene expression changes associated with that subtype of the tumor.
So when you're doing these high-throughput drug screens, are you taking an individual's brain tumor and screening all of these thousands of drugs to see which drug would be best for that particular patient?
Yes. So in essence, we are. So what we do is we have cell line models where we take the mutation that was found in a specific patient, and then we express it in a model system because we want to clear out all the noise associated with other genetic changes in that individual and ask the question, well, this brain tumor harbors this gene mutation, and we'd like to find a drug that targets that gene mutation. And in the old days when there used to be, you know, a very small number of drugs that are available for patients, this is in the 50s and 60s, it was a different story because there was really nothing more we could offer them. But now we know that there are hundreds of thousands of drugs out there yet to be discovered that we can use specifically to target that gene mutation.
So this patient who was in his garden, who had the seizure and came in with the glioblastoma, is it that every patient now has, you know, a biopsy done of their brain tumor and they're genomically profiled? And because you identify a mutation in point X, you now know that drug Y is the right drug to treat that patient?
That's an That is exactly where we need to be. And my best answer to that is that we're almost there. And, you know, incredibly thankful for cancer research funding in this day and era. As we all know, it's difficult with the funding climate. But because of that funding, we've now gotten to that position. And again, I remarked that, you know, so I trained here as a medical student here at Yale. And even in the last 10 years, coming back near on faculty, it's completely changed. And now we know these gene mutations. And we're just beginning to start the clinical trials to do exactly what you said, is this patient has a gene mutation here, and let's come up with a tailored therapy. So my guess would be that in the next 5 to 10 years, this will become almost common practice for brain tumors.
That's fantastic. Now, at the beginning of the show, you said that you don't just treat adults, you treat kids too. So do kids get brain tumors?
Yep. And unfortunately, well, thankfully, again, rare that kids get brain tumors. But unfortunately, children get these same highly aggressive tumors, namely glioblastoma and another tumor called a brainstem glioma. There are a number of other cancer types in children, such as leukemia and lymphoma. But pediatric brain tumors are an interesting entity because really only in the last 2 to 3 years have we understood that these brain tumors, although again look identical under the microscope, are completely different. And unfortunately, in previous years, we used to just take adult experimental therapies for brain tumors and apply them to children. And now we're understanding through the last 3 to 4 years of research that these are actually unique tumors and actually need to have their own therapies developed for them.
So pediatric brain tumors are entirely different from adult brain tumors?
It was completely surprising, and there's a string of papers of the last 2 years that have come out, and they look exactly the same under the microscope, and the mutations that are common in adults are actually rare in children, and there's new sets of mutations that actually affect the way that the genome curls around itself. So these are called mutations in chromatin modifying genes. We're finding these mutations that we've never even knew were possible, only in pediatric brain tumors, which is fascinating and makes us realize that we're just beginning to understand where we can go therapeutically with those tumors.
Yeah, and hence finding those mutations and knowing which mutations are which is really helpful.
Yes, exactly. I think that's the case.
So when kids present with brain tumors, is it the same set of symptoms? I mean, is it the seizures that adults present with?
So kids present with very similar findings, and it's often a very, you know, different. Often I'll tell my residents, you know, isn't it funny how the workup and management of a child with a brain tumor is very similar, yet the entire context is different. I mean, often it's, you know, they're at daycare and they start acting a little bit odd and different from what they're used to, and it's much harder with children because, you know, children, but I have a 3.5-year-old at home, and she's quite quirky and sometimes does some things you wouldn't expect, and unfortunately that often draws out the diagnosis for children. But I think one of the biggest struggles with children with brain tumors is it becomes an all-encompassing event. That entire family comes to your clinic, and you know the mom and dad are devastated and confused, and rightly so, because they weren't expecting their beautiful young child to now have this brain tumor.
Yeah, I can imagine that. You know, not only is it devastating when you get the diagnosis, but I'm still struggling with how did they get there. I mean, I am certain that there are people who are listening to us who are thinking, I have a kid. My kid goes to daycare. They act odd all the time. Does my kid have a brain tumor? Can you give us an example of what might be an event or something that makes people take their kids to the doctor? I mean, if you have a seizure and you end up unconscious in your garden, I get it. You're going to go to the hospital. But But how are pediatric brain cancers diagnosed?
Yeah, so it's funny because when I trained at Sloan Kettering during my residency, and I still remember the first patient, the first child that I treated as a resident there, and actually inspired me to go into pediatrics, and she had a brainstem glioma, and it was picked up because she had slurred speech, and it was persistent, and one side of her face started drooping. So often those are, you know, very clear telltale signs. And I still remember actually the look on her face and her parents when you know the side of her right side of her face started drooping, and it was clear pretty quickly in that case that she had a brain tumor. She ultimately was found to have something called a brainstem glioma, where the entire brainstem gets replaced by a high grade tumor.
So, you know, one of the things that is so difficult in what we do is you know really helping people through the diagnosis of cancer. And one of the things that I love about what I do as a breast cancer surgeon is, you know, I get to tell people, congratulations, you know what, you may have cancer now, but in a day or a week, we'll take you to the operating room, we'll take out that cancer, you'll be cancer free, and your outcomes are going to be fantastic, and you're going to live a long and healthy life and forever and ever, amen. It's different with kids, and particularly kids who have high grade brain tumors. Tell us about that.
I think that's it's an excellent point, and it's something that we struggle with, I think, almost every day. I think one of the hardest things that I've had to learn as a new attending here at Yale is breaking news, and breaking news in the context of when, to some degree, many would say there is no hope. What I do tell my patients now is that, you know, times are changing, and just around the corner, we're not sure when there's a new therapy that'll be available. One of the biggest challenges is speaking to a family, though, and trying to explain to them that their child has an 80% chance of not surviving past 5 years. And we just had a conversation with a family last week about this, a patient that had a high-grade glioma. And I think one of the most fascinating things for me is when you look at that child, often the child has no concept and no idea of what's happening to them. And to some degree, it makes it almost a 10 times more bearable to see that child because they're so happy. And I tell my residents, you know, we as a society, you know, we have a responsibility to take care of our children because they're helpless and they're depending on us. And so as doctors, you know, that is just as important. We have to take care of these kids with brain tumors. And as a result, seeing these kids succumb from their tumors, it drives me, it drives my lab staff, it drives all of us here at this hospital. Because at the end of the day, what parents don't want to hear is that there is no hope. And so what we try to do is we say, listen, you know, we're in the lab, we're working on this. And sometimes we've been frank with them, it may not be for your child. But I want you to know that, you know, your child is inspiring us to work. Recently, I was just awarded a grant from a small foundation, and it was I was able to speak with the founders later, and it turns out that they actually had known about the same child who died of a brainstem glioma, and they had interacted with that family, and all of a sudden I realized it was actually that patient at Sloan Kettering that I just told you about, and through them I was able to send a message to them. And I said, you know, I just want you all to know that, you know, I've received this grant from this foundation, and a lot of it stemmed from my interaction with your daughter who passed away at about 3 years old. And it was nice. They sent a message back through the foundation. So obviously, you know, very relatively anonymous. And they said, you know, this means the world to us that our daughter's not forgotten. So I think to some degree, it is frustrating. We walk out of these tumor boards and sometimes you say, you know, everyone's dying. This isn't going to get fixed. But then you start to realize that, you know, eventually with enough ingenuity and people all working together at institutions like here and elsewhere, that we will find a cure for this disease. And it's really just a matter of time.
Dr. Ranjit Bindra is Assistant Professor of Therapeutic Radiology and of Pathology and Assistant Professor of Therapeutic Radiology at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or comments, we invite you to visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of previously broadcast episodes. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.